welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And our show today, this is going to be a smooth, full show. But we're going to run through it like a knife through butter, okay? And a hot knife through butter, okay? And now I got all the trite little metaphors out of the way. I'm going to jump right into what the show is going to be about today. I had to get that out of my system first, though. At the back end of the show, we're going to be joined by Tim Wright, the artistic director of the Circle X Theater Company, and actors Wes Liang and Elizabeth Ho on the company's current play, The Chinese Massacre Annotated. And we'll be talking about that. It's the largest mass lynching in the history of the U.S. That's what the play's about, and I won't tell you any more until you stay tuned and listen to it. Before that, we'll be joined by P.Z. Myers, biologist and associate professor at the University of Minnesota Morris, author of the science blog Peringula, and the show's resident scientific Rottweiler and mad scientist. So we'll be talking about all kinds of things on that segment. But first up, I'm really happy to be doing this segment. It's an extremely important segment, and I think actually over the last week what we've seen was suddenly this sort of dark tower, this mythological torture chamber that has been sitting out there off the shore. Who knew what was going on? Nobody knew much of anything that was going on inside the place. It's kind of those things that, you know, that you know is there. It's hanging around. You hear rumors. But for the first time ever over the last week, just a massive release of documents released by WikiLeaks detailing quite a bit of information that we didn't know about Guantanamo and what's going on inside Guantanamo. And joining us to talk about that is Andy Worthington. Andy's been a frequent guest on this show, and he's a WikiLeaks media partner for the release of these documents. He's also the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, and he's co-director of the film Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. Andy, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. It's very good to be talking to you from just off a road up in about 70 miles north of London. So I'm on a cell phone, and I do hope that the power's going to be enough for us to have this conversation the whole way through.
I certainly hope so, too. I'm glad you gave us that warning. Now you made me nervous, brother. So stand right where you are because you sound good, okay? Why don't we start then by you giving us an overall sense of what's the significance of this massive document release? What do the documents reveal, and why do you consider them so important?
Well, you know, these documents are the assessments that were prepared by the military in Guantanamo to be reviewed, you know, to see whether prisoners should continue to be held or whether they should be released. And so what they particularly contain, I think, is detailed information about how the military has come by its information that it's used to justify holding prisoners or not justifying holding them. And there is nothing spectacularly new in the sense that documents have been released before which have demonstrated the extent to which innocent people and insignificant foot soldiers have been held. But these documents reveal, like never before, the extent to which the U.S. government has been relying on the testimony of the prisoners' fellow prisoners to justify holding them. That the majority of the information that purports to be intelligence is extracted from their fellow prisoners post-capture. So, you know, and the problem with that, and this is where it's going to take people a little bit of time to examine what's going on, is that these are people whose testimony is generally untrustworthy, and there are two reasons for that, really. One is either, Michael, that these are people who were held in secret CIA prisons, the high-value detainees. One of these men is Abu Zubaydah. He keeps turning up over and over again. Well, you know, this is the man for whom the torture memos were written by lawyers in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. This is the man who was waterboarded, subjected to a form of controlled drowning 83 times in August 2002. And here he is telling stories about prisoners that are used as supposed evidence. Well, how trustworthy is his evidence? And then what we also have are prisoners who were held in Guantanamo itself, not as high-value detainees, but as regular prisoners, but ones who we know, and this has been evident from other sources over the years, are renowned as informants. So, again, people who have made statements about a large number of their fellow prisoners, but whose evidence, again, is untrustworthy. Not in this case particularly because these people were subjected to torture or other forms of coercion, but because some of them were actually kind of bribed, if you like. They were offered better living conditions if they provided information, or when they provided information, they were rewarded, even though there were people warning that their information may not have been that reliable. And so some of these people have turned up in the media over the years. They've been mentioned there. They've certainly been mentioned, some of them, in the prisoners' habeas corpus petitions in the district court in Washington, D.C. over the last 2 years. And that's where I think there's been the most interesting overlap with these documents, is that judges have been looking at the evidence closely and saying, look, this guy keeps turning up in the evidence, and we know he's not reliable, and they're fighting internal military reports, warning that they don't think these people are reliable. And yet here we see in the documents it's being laid out more openly than it's ever been before. Here are the people that the government has been relying on, and it's the same people. It's the same unreliable witnesses.
We're talking with Andy Worthington, who's the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, and actually one of the journalists in the world who's actually been on the case of Guantanamo from the very beginning. I think it's really significant, the work you've done, Andy. And I'd ask you this. You talked about, in addition to what you've just been saying, you actually mentioned that one key element that did come out in these documents is the story of the first 200 or so detainees who were released very early on, which before these documents, people didn't know anything about them. Tell us about that and why it's important that that happened.
But yeah, I mean, what's actually happened over the years is that from 2005 onwards, there were great and successful attempts made primarily by media organizations suing the U.S. government, getting them to release documentation relating to the prisoners. And a lot of what has come out over the years, we know about because of the summaries of evidence and the transcripts of the tribunals they held at Guantanamo. Now, what they covered was from summer 2004 onwards. Now, before that period, 200 of the nearly 800 people who had been held at Guantanamo, so a quarter of the total population of the prison, were released. And as you mentioned there, Michael, no official documentation has ever been released by the U.S. government relating to these people. Now, you know, in my detailed studies over the years of Guantanamo, I dug up some of these stories, either through media reports or they were interviewed afterwards. Even with my most diligent searching, half of these 200 people I knew nothing at all about, just their names and their dates of birth, that was it. The country of origin. So all these stories have come out, and I'm very glad to say that some of the media has picked up on these stories and have recognized that these are some of the many innocent people held at Guantanamo, the people who were seized by mistake and taken to Guantanamo because there was no screening process in place, because the commands came down from on high, that everybody who ended up in U.S. custody, whether they'd been bought, whether they'd been rounded up as a result of poor intelligence, whatever, everybody had to go to Guantanamo. And here are the people, this is the result. When you don't screen people, you get farmers, you get taxi drivers, you get old men. There's an old man, several old men were taken to Guantanamo in their 70s and 80s. A man with senile dementia. Children as young as, well, according to the records, 14. Although over the years it seems to have been established that some of the prisoners may have been as young as 12. There were a couple of dozen juveniles taken to Guantanamo. And these old men who, you know, we're talking about, one with senile dementia. There was another old man who was seized. Special forces came to his house in the middle of the night. He was deaf. He couldn't understand what they were talking about. So they took him to Guantanamo instead. I mean, really, stories like this that are absolutely ridiculous. And these have emerged by the dozens in these documents that have never been released before. And like I say, it's been reassuring to see mainstream media outlets who have been working with WikiLeaks on these documents, picking up on these stories and actually saying to the world in a noticeable manner, here's evidence of a significant number of mistakes that were made. You know, I'm hoping that encourages people to examine further the whole faulty structure, really, of Guantanamo in the first place.
You know, one of the things that happens, Andy, is that when you're looking at this, and I know the New Yorker did a really nice little article about the reasons people were held in Guantanamo, and you refer to this too, and I thought it was really interesting. And the different things that got them sent to Guantanamo, everything from which you've spoken a little bit about the Casio watch, but also I found other things that were really interesting. The attitude towards the Star Spangled Banner. Boy, I'd be in trouble. And ties with Pakistan's intelligence service. Those are kind of really, really, really interesting.
Well, they are, yeah. And I'll tell you what's interesting, and I don't think it's really been picked up on yet. These documents explain the reasons that people were sent to Guantanamo. And under that, you will find all kinds of terrible explanations, actually, in some cases. I mean, there's a British man who was held in a Taliban jail. In other words, he had been imprisoned because they thought he was a spy. Under the reasons for him being in Guantanamo, it suggested that he would be able to help explain the kind of interrogation methods used by the Taliban. not really a very adequate justification, I don't think. Now, what's interesting is that the other stories that you were mentioning, these are the kind of things that are coming out in here. But in a way, this whole thing is a smokescreen. You know, as I mentioned, everybody who came into U.S. custody had to be sent to Guantanamo. An interrogator who worked in the prisons in Afghanistan, where the prisoners were processed for Guantanamo, he wrote a book under the pseudonym Chris Mackey. He explained in that book, he laid it out clearly, every single person had to go to Guantanamo. So these stories of why they were sent to Guantanamo are actually a cover. What they are is that when they got there, then they started trying to find some justification for holding them. And that's when they grafted on, if you like, these reasons. So, you know, objectively, some of that looks like it makes sense. You know, person was sent here to explain the movement of jihadists into Afghanistan, whatever. Then you start examining it closely, and you do get these stories like the one I mentioned. A man held by the Taliban as a prisoner can explain Taliban interrogation techniques. All kinds of weird reasons are scattered around the place. And the Pakistan's ISI, for example. Well, you know, was America working with Pakistan's ISI or at odds with Pakistan's ISI? I think that one exposes a little bit of the confusions going on that the ISI, Pakistan's top intelligence agency, which, you know, is long been regarded as having played a major role in the rise of the Taliban in the first place, is also, during the war on terror, is an ally of the United States, and yet is this organization that's been involved in supporting the Taliban. So who's playing who and what's going on, really? But the ISI thing also, I think Michael touches on another shocking story, which I hope people will find in these documents, which is that there are terror organizations who are put on official blacklists by the State Department and by other U.S. departments. And these are official. When it came to Guantanamo, some of these organizations were there, but pretty much anything that they invented or could find out in Guantanamo, they used against the prisoners, regardless of whether those organizations were regarded legitimately as involved in terrorism outside of Guantanamo. So you had an organization called Jamaat al-Qabli. Now, this is a pretty conservative missionary organization, but it's a legitimate organization. It has over 3 million members worldwide, and yet, within Guantanamo, it was regarded as a front for terrorist activities. I mean, my analogy for this has always been that it would be akin to designating the Catholic Church as a terrorist organization because the members of the IRA were Catholics. It's so broad and so sweeping, and yet within Guantanamo, anything that they could find out against the prisoners could be used against them.
There were people that they did go after for very specific reasons, which you can see the politics behind it. And apparently in somewhere in the documents, there was something about how they even considered the BBC to be a propaganda outlet for Al-Qaeda because some people had been caught with a phone number for the BBC in their pocket. You know, and you can look at that and say, okay, well, the hell with that. But then there's Sami Al-Haj, which was really, I think, a really, really incredibly important case. And one that actually, I think, too often gets swept under the rug and just sort of not right out there in the forefront. And that was very heavy because they were very clearly after not just him, but after Al Jazeera.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, Sami Al-Haj is a cameraman with Al Jazeera, and he was covering the U.S. occupation with Al Jazeera in Afghanistan. He went back to Pakistan. The guys were all sorting out their papers for another visit. On the border, he's apprehended, you know, at the request of the U.S., you know, and ends up spending years in Guantanamo solely on this basis, exactly. But what he has said over the years, and what is corroborated here, is that they wanted to find a way to infiltrate Al-Qaeda, Al-Jazeera, I beg your pardon, to find a way to bring this network down, and that they were trying to use Sami Al-Haj as the method of doing that. Now, you know, I spoke to somebody the other day who is a journalist who raised this as well, and I'm very, very glad that you did, Michael, but, you know, surely every journalist who values the profession really ought to be picking up on this story, also picking up on this story of how the Bush administration was trying to go after the BBC at one point to defend our colleagues.
We're talking with journalist Andy Worthington about what the Guantanamo documents recently released from WikiLeaks reveal about America's premier dungeon and its torture chambers all over the world. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you, too, following up on that, one of the points that you made on your website is that this is, with the release of these documents, this is the first time ever that there's actually proof of prisoners being sent to other countries to be tortured before being sent to Guantanamo. And I think that's an extremely important point here because it ties in with, you know, as you were saying earlier about the people who often are used to provide intelligence, so-called intelligence about the risk assessments of other prisoners, are people who have been just inhumanely and savagely tortured. And now these documents are showing that there are this string of torture chambers that service the U.S. intelligence and the U.S. system all around the world. And this is the first time that it's actually been shown that these prisoners are being sent to these countries to be tortured before they're sent to Guantanamo. That's a pretty heavy revelation.
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, you know, I think that's the thing, is that people, you know, I'm not even sure that people who've been working in this field for many years have quite gathered that, you know, there are a lot of clues scattered in these documents. Because if you've been in the human rights field for all these years, you know, from every other source apart from the U.S. government, the stories have emerged of either of the secret prisons run by the CIA or of the proxy facilities that were in other countries where torturers there were working directly for the CIA. You know, they would torture somebody and then immediately get on the phone and report what had happened. I mean, Human Rights Watch did a great report on the facility in Jordan a few years back. It's called Double Jeopardy, and people should be able to find it online. But the U.S. government has never, ever admitted publicly, officially, that this is what happened. And, yeah, in the documents, this is exactly what we're seeing. I mean, what I've seen in some of the documents to date is confirmation that people were sent to Jordan and that people were sent to Egypt. And there's more in there. I mean, and this is, you know, this is definitely very useful. And it's in contrast to what we see with some of the other particular high-value detainees, for example, you know, the 14, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who arrived in Guantanamo in September 2006 from secret CIA prisons, because, you know, their previous existence after capture is just a blank. In all of these documents, it's not mentioned where they were. They inexplicably disappeared off the face of the earth for up to 3.5 years in the case of Abu Zubaydah, but their journeys around secret prisons are not mentioned. It's in some of the cases of some of these other prisoners, you know, and it's very useful in helping to piece together a story that we really haven't heard enough of, you know, and at some point there has to be some kind of accountability for the fact that, according to statements made in documents or in speeches over the years, 94 prisoners were held in a high-value detainee program, and somewhere we get the feeling somewhere between, say, in the 60s or the 70s of prisoners were sent to other countries. So we've got less than 200 people here altogether. But these are people who disappeared into a secret prison network, either run by the CIA or on behalf of the CIA. Now, roughly 36 or more of these guys eventually turned up in Guantanamo. Over the years, a handful of them were released. Over the years, we've heard reports about how some of them were returned to their home countries, like Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, who turns up in the documents and who told the lie about the connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein when he was being tortured in Egypt that was used to justify the invasion of Iraq. There are dozens and dozens of these people whose names we don't even know, or if we do know their names, we don't know what happened to them. You know, it's a whole big part of the problem, you know, and when you look at it in this way, Guantanamo is kind of the tip of an iceberg in a way. And Guantanamo, which even with these documents is not, I'm sure you'll agree, the most transparent place on earth, looks remarkably transparent compared to, you know, the history of these other facilities,
which has
just never been exposed. I mean, never been exposed.
Right, and that's a very, very important point, very good point. Now, we have to end on this one last question, and we'll have to do it within about 2 minutes. What might this hold for the future? I mean, we're looking at a scene where they've talked about there's not going to be any trials in courts in the U.S. They're talking about they're going to have the military tribunals. What impact do you think the release of these documents revealing all this about Guantanamo might have for the future?
Well, I hope it provides, you know, education for people who need to know. I mean, the American people and people outside of America. Now, unfortunately, the problem, it seems to me, is that there, you know, there is not any impetus in the United States to push for the closure of Guantanamo. You know, there isn't enough of a movement amongst the people, and, you know, crucially, there isn't enough interest in the mainstream media or in Congress, for example. I mean, you know, laughably, there's virtually no interest at all in Congress. You know, now I think that remains intolerable, and I certainly hope that this is revived the discussion. But I think more is required. And I'm not entirely sure, Michael, what's the best way forward. My feeling is that, you know, the Obama administration needs to be shamed into doing something by the international community in the way that George W. Bush was shamed after Abu Ghraib, in the years following Abu Ghraib, particularly, I think, in 2005, 2006, you know, by criticism from the United Nations, from religious figures around the world, by world leaders. Now, I realize that we're not looking at the same kind of torture program going on that happened under the worst of the Bush years, but what we still have at Guantanamo is a prison that doesn't conform to any internationally agreed standards, where the people held are still held as the, you know, the unique category of human being that the Bush administration wanted. They're not enemy prisoners of war, according to the Geneva Conventions. They're not criminal suspects. They're still essentially Bush's enemy combatants, mm-hmm. you know, and that gives great comfort to mainly people on the right in the United States who like the idea that they've got special prisoners who should have as few rights as possible. Yes. You know, and that's wrong, and it remains a stain on President Obama's reputation, I think. And I think, you know, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. Maybe he wins the next election, maybe not. It's possible that, you know, somebody in the future may more aggressively wish to pursue the kind of things that President Bush implemented. And unless something's done, they're going to be handed it on a plate, because Obama has done very little to actually dismantle what took place.
Exactly. And Andy, on that note, we're going to have to close it off, man.
Michael, no problem.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Andy. I really appreciate talking with you, as always, and we'll have you back soon.
Okay.
Okay, take care, Andy.
All right, Michael. Thanks. Bye.
If you're just joining us, we've been talking with journalist Andy Worthington about the recently released Guantanamo files. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by P.Z. Myers, our resident scientific Rottweiler and the author of the scientific blog Feringhella, the most popular science blog in the world. So stay tuned.
For my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
He did the monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my lab.
Okay, and regular listeners to the show know that that theme song, when you hear that song, the Monster Mash, that song is the sign that our next guest is going to be P.Z. Myers. I'm really happy to welcome back to the show our recurring guest. He's the, and what I prefer to say, is the show's scientific Rottweiler. He may want to have some other creature that he wants to be, but actually his scientific Rottweiler does me well, because Rottweilers are among my favorite people. There you go. Okay. P.Z. Myers, the author of the world's most popular science blog, Feringhella. P.Z., welcome to the show.
Hello. Glad to be back.
Yeah. So how's that scientific Rottweiler stand with you?
Yeah, I kind of like those dogs too. You know, they've got a nastier reputation than they deserve, so...
Yeah, and you know, a large part of it has to do with what we talk about all the time, is that they've been demonized in all those satanic movies. You know, they're God's enemy.
Yeah.
Well, let's start this way. What is it that's bugging you, or that you think is extremely important to talk about this month in relation to everything you do, science, atheism, the intersection of the two? What's something that's really bugging you right now?
Really bugging me. Well, the latest thing is Paul Davies, who annoyed me greatly when I read his recent article this morning.
Well, tell us about it.
Okay, so Paul Davies, as you know, is a reputable physicist, apparently by all accounts. He's a good cosmologist, and he published this strange thing in The Guardian today where he mentioned he'd been invited to consult on cancer research. Well, when I actually looked at what he said about cancer research, it's clear that he doesn't know anything at all about cancer. He actually admits that right at the beginning, that he had no prior knowledge of cancer at all. So he came up with this bizarre hypothesis of that involved recapitulation theory, and how cancer cells were regressed cells that were acting like ancient cells living in colonies, which is all total nonsense, because recapitulation manipulation theory is false, his premises are wrong, and...
Give us a little bit of an understanding for people who don't know. Give us a little bit clearer of a sense of what is recapitulation theory and what's wrong with it.
Okay, so way back in the 19th century, this guy Ernst Haeckel came up with an explanation for development. You know, the embryo goes through a series of stages, and what he said is each of these stages represents an era in our developmental history. So we, for instance, go through a fish stage, and then we go through an amphibian stage, and a reptile stage, and a general mammal stage, and a primate stage, and finally the human stage, and then eventually we're born. This is total nonsense. We don't do that. It was popular for, you know, about 20, 30 years, over 100 years ago, and then people realized that, no, this is not true. That, for instance, we go through stages where our embryos resemble the embryos of fish, but that's only because the embryo at that stage is just kind of a smudge with just the barest minimum of features. It's an exaggeration. It's a really poor basis. It's a very poor basis to make an argument against cancer. Not a way to attack cancer to say, well, it's going through an ancient stage. Simply makes no sense at all to say that.
And it doesn't make sense because it's not true?
Because it's not true.
Aha!
Yeah, that's not how development works. It's not how evolution works. And when you look at cancer cells, what you find is cells that are expressing perfectly normal patterns of proliferation. It's just that they're doing it without regulation. They're supposed to divide. They're supposed to proliferate. But they're also supposed to be regulated so they don't divide out of control. It's just a peculiar thing that this well-known physicist comes out and is arguing baloney for biology.
So the cancer cells are sort of like renegade anarchists, huh?
Right, yes. That all cells in your body are supposed to be dedicated to supporting the whole, not the individual, and so they are all tightly regulated. You know, for instance, another disease is diabetes, right? Diabetes is a defect where all of the cells refuse to take up the sugar that's circulating the bloodstream. The cells are supposed to receive a signal from insulin in order to take up sugar from the bloodstream. And that's because, you know, you don't want the first cell to encounter the sugar rush from your meal to gobble everything up, and then the cells farther out get nothing. So all of your cells are very polite and well-mannered. They obey the commands of the pancreas, and they only eat when they are told to. Except if you've got cancer, what's happened is they've lost their table manners, and they just start chowing down and greedily growing as quickly as possible.
You know, I don't have cancer, and I'll tell you what, though. I think my cells are just straight-up anarchistic renegades. They are all out for number one, all right? And I can always tell I'm swelling in different places after each meal, okay?
Uh-huh.
Well, now, here's the thing. Why is it so important that, now this person has really bugged you, and why is it so important to take this on? I mean, I read something on your blog about that this morning, actually, and one of the things that you were saying was that you were looking at it as it was a really creative thing to be bringing in into the study of in the field of cancer, scientists who might not actually have any expertise in that region, in that field, in a certain sense, in order to provide the possibility that they might provide some fresh insight. But there's something to getting fresh insight, but what is it that, you know, you were particularly irked by the fact that this cat came in and then just advanced these theories that weren't true, as you're saying? Do you think there's any importance to doing that, developing a collectivity of scientists to work on a really knotty problem like cancer?
Yeah, so an interdisciplinary approach can be very, very helpful. The physicist might very well bring in his expertise in how matter interacts with other pieces of matter, because cells are simply matter interacting with other cells. So, you know, I could see where understanding the physical properties of adhesion, for instance, would be something a physicist could help with. They also have all these math skills, so I could imagine all these math skills being harnessed to do interesting things in the analysis of cancer. But he didn't do any of these things. What he did is he resurrected a dead theory from old school biology and seemed to try to apply that to the problem inappropriately. So it really didn't help us much at all. You know, again, interdisciplinary approaches are great. We would love to have more people contributing to these problems and giving us new perspectives. But sometimes, you know, you get people come in and they know absolutely nothing about the problem and they can't contribute. And I think Paul Davies is one of those. He does not know any biology, and he especially doesn't know any cancer biology. So he's kind of floundering. He's actually holding things up because here's this old slow guy who doesn't know anything in the field, and we all know it much better than he does, and you've got to stop and give him instruction. And No, he's not helping. Sorry.
Quick reminder, we're talking with P.Z. Myers, scientist and author of the world's most popular science blog, Pharyngula. Well, you know, it's interesting because it seems that science in general, seems to be a magnet for that kind of stuff. I mean, people oftentimes speaking up and saying things that they purport to be scientifically real and genuine and of value and actually are hogwash. You know, it's sort of a...
Oh, yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because science has a lot of authority. Scientists are smart guys. You know, who do we think of as the models when we want to say, oh, well, he's a smart person? You say he's a rocket scientist or a brain surgeon or something. So it's a prestigious thing to be knowledgeable about the science. So that's what they're trying to do, is acquire a kind of false authority. So that's one factor. And then, of course, the other is that science has immediate effects. Particularly in biology, we get this all the time, because biology is so closely related to the health fields. So, you know, there's quite a bit of money to be made in pretending to know something about how to make somebody healthier. And so the advertising on television, in your magazines, is thick with all kinds of strange, strange things advertised as promoting your health, making you better, built often on bogus premises like homeopathy.
I was in New York a couple weeks ago, and I have one of those sleeping machines that makes you look like sort of a demented elephant at night, you know, sort of with the long hose coming out. And to run it properly, you have to get distilled water. And I was walking around looking in drugstores for distilled water. And, you know, I couldn't find any distilled water. I found water that said, and you talked about this, that called itself real water, and it was vapor distilled water, and it talked about getting water from clouds, the purest form of water. And I kept thinking, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, there's these labels they put on things that are supposed to make you think this is magic stuff. You know, natural is one of those things. What does natural mean? Just about everything is natural. I mean, belladonna is natural, and yet it's a lethal poison. But somehow this has become a magic buzzword. Make it sound good. Other words that you run into are traditional. So somehow traditional is supposed to mean it's better, and I don't get that either, because tradition is often dead wrong. Give me something new. Well, of course, then new becomes another buzzword.
Well, here's a question, too, though, because, you know, I know that some people, for instance, I had a friend who had stage 4 cancer, and it was an unspecified origin, primary origin, or whatever. And one of the things that he was actually trying to do was they couldn't figure out where the specific cancer was, what type of cancer it was, but he went to a cat who marshaled all the forces that modern science and medicine had to marshal. He also then looked at things like the kind of medicine that existed in China, not absorbing it wholesale, nor disregarding everything that was in there, because there's oftentimes things that people have discovered and developed over the course of centuries that actually do have some kind of natural medicinal impact, but you can't replace one with the other.
Right. I mean, the best example of that, of course, is aspirin, which has had a place in traditional folklore for a long, long time. You know, willow bark, that's what it comes from, for treatment of pain, and it was quite right. However, if you're going to take something like that and move it into the realm of tested, tried, useful medicine, you've got to subject it to those tests. And most of those natural, traditional remedies flop. They just don't do much of anything when you actually test.
We're talking today with P.Z. Myers from the University of Minnesota and author of Pharyngula, the world's most popular science blog. That leads me into this. There's been a big controversy that you've also been involved in an ongoing way, and that is around the question of the relationship between religion and science. And you recently talked about a guy named Martin Rees. You were pretty outraged about what he was saying around this because it actually advocated a conciliation between religion and science. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yes. So Martin Rees is a British physicist who recently won the Templeton Prize. He's also an unbeliever. He does not believe in God. He's still a traditional churchgoer, though, because he says that he likes the architecture and he likes the ritual, a very common sort of argument. Anyway, so basically all he has done in this area is said, leave the religious alone, let them do whatever they want. I don't believe, but I kind of think they have pretty architecture. And for this, he won a £1 million prize. That's kind of outrageous right there, giving him a reward for something so petty and so trivial. And then also he's recently come out after he got this award, and now he's working for Templeton, basically, telling the world, yeah, leave all those religious people alone, that it's outrageous to criticize religion, because apparently it's all nicey-nicey, lovey-dovey, easy on the heart and eyes stuff.
Thing is if it was just him saying that, it would be one thing, and even getting that award, it's not even, you know, look, people get lots of moolah for very, very shady things.
Not me. I'm kind of disappointed now.
I was going to say, I've invented many things, most of which turned out to be little, like a string tied to the light switch that I convinced my son was the magic on-off switch. It was just that old sheer laziness. I didn't have to get out of bed to turn the light off when I was done reading, okay?
Yes. So, that's brilliant.
Yeah, there you go. But I couldn't get money for it. But here's the thing is that this actually has a massive social impact, and it ties into what we were just talking about. Because in this society, this is one of the few times in human history where we actually have the capacity to understand the world very, very deeply and how it is and how it's developing and how to interact with it in order to change it. At the same time, we live in a world that seems to be really hell-bent on masking that, keeping people broadly blind as to actually what science reveals about the world and what it is and how to change it. You know, and I was thinking about that in relation to, you had a letter that Jerry Coyne, another biologist, evolutionary biologist who is remarkable, we've had on the show a number of times, wrote on this subject that I thought was very, very compelling. Can you tell people what that was?
Yeah, so a number of us have some complaints about the National Center for Science Education. It's a well-known organization, and I really like them and want to support them. They've done a marvelous job of combating creationists, so they advocate for good teaching of evolution. There's also a British organization called the BCSE, which does a similar sort of thing in their country. But lately, I think they've come adrift, and what they've been doing is, instead of just promoting good science and staying out of the atheist wars, which I think is just fine, they should stay out of that, let other people who care about that fight over that. Instead of staying away from it, what they have instead done is constantly and consistently promoted this idea that there is a liberal Christianity that is perfectly compatible with evolution, which means that they're basically endorsing sectarian religion on their website. I can sort of sympathize, because myself, I would also favor more people being of the liberal Christian bent, but that's not the job of the NCSE to tell people which religion they ought to follow, that they ought to be more secular, they ought to stay out of that whole arena and just talk about science education. But no, they're not, and one of their members and also a past member have been quite active in attacking atheists, which is fine for them to do as individuals, but this is not something that the NCSE should be involved in. And the NCSE doesn't seem to want to distance themselves from this. So they're just coming off as very pro-religion, well, pro-certain kinds of religion, and that's making us uncomfortable.
Well, why? Here's the question, because it's the promotion of good science, but you also go out, in your own work, you go out and you fight for atheism.
Yes,
you
know? I do.
Yeah, and so why does this make you uncomfortable that there may be
some... Oh, because I do not pretend to be objective on this matter. I do not pretend to be avoiding this topic. If the NCSE wants to come out and start battling for liberal Christianity, then they ought to be honest and say it. But if you read their website, what they have is lots of disclaimers where they're just saying, no, they're a secular scientific organization, and at the same time they get all this stuff where they say, here's this particular religion that has no problem with evolution. You know, you'll never see me on my website saying, oh, I don't take sides on religion. I pretty blatantly do take sides. And so, you know, it's like it often is with these problems. It's not necessarily the crime, which may be pretty petty. It's the cover-up and the hypocrisy that drives us nuts.
Well, it does have an impact in the world. You know, I think that really is a very important aspect of it. It does have an impact when scientists or people fighting for a scientific understanding of the world are simultaneously coddling religions. You know, it's one thing to demand that all scientists immediately declare that they're atheists. That's wrong. But to actually propagate that and push that out there in a big way, it seems to me very important in terms of the impact that all this can have in the world.
Oh, definitely. I mean, if you're going to be teaching science, you know, the kinds of things you teach is not a set of rote facts. What you teach is critical thinking and evaluation of the evidence. That's what you've got to do. And religion doesn't hold up under that kind of scrutiny. You cannot advocate looking at the evidence for Christianity, for instance, because you will find it falls to pieces pretty quickly. So what the NCSD ought to be doing is simply staying away from that issue altogether. If they want to be very diplomatic about it, I would favor them just saying, okay, we're not going to talk about religion at all. When they say, well, we support this kind of liberal religion, they're basically announcing to the world that they are willing to ignore those standards for evidence and critical thinking in this one area. And that's not good.
That's an extremely important point. And on that, I want to move toward ending this. Actually, I don't want to, but I got to. And I want to end it with a quote that you cited from Richard Feynman. And it actually had a lot of relevance to this. And it said, "Reality must take precedence over public relations, for nature cannot be fooled." And I thought that was an extremely important point to make. And thank you for bringing that quote to my attention and to the attention of the world.
Yes, well, Feynman has a number of quotes along those lines. You know, science is what you do to avoid fooling yourself. He was very, very stringent on this point that, yeah, you examine claims critically. You don't just let them slide by. Because it is so easy for us to fool ourselves, science is a tool we use to reinforce our critical faculties and evaluate evidence properly.
All right, PZ, thank you very much for joining us this week.
Very good. I'm pleased to do it. Let's do it again next month.
Yes, we definitely will. Take care, man.
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot, PZ. Bye now. You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've just been talking with P.Z. Myers, professor at the University of Minnesota Morris, and the author of the science blog Pharyngula, the most popular science blog in the world. We're going to take a quick break and be right back to talk with Tim Wright, the artistic director of the Circle X Theater Company, and Elizabeth Ho and West Liang, two of the actors in The Chinese Massacre, Annotated. So stay tuned.
Why didn't you come when I beat my drum and scream off my head out into the night? Scared of the slums, afraid of the guns, don't wanna see their hoodlums fight. Hey, na 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 na, don't wanna see their hoodlums fight. Hey, na 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 na, don't wanna see their hoodlums fight. I was gonna come when I heard your drum and you scream your head off into the night. I grew up around different part of town, but even the universes collide. Hey, na 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 na, even the universes collide. Hey, na 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 na, even the universes collide. There was no weather, no family matter, and by the costas we don't divide. It's just father told me tonight, authorities preparing ethno cleansing ride. Hey, na 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 na, preparing ethno cleansing ride.
Welcome back. It's Gogo Bordello with When Universes Collide, preparing ethno-cleansing rites. It's a really remarkable song, a very powerful song, and one that means a hell of a lot in connection to our next segment on the show. I'm really happy to be having as guests Tim Wright, the artistic director of the Circle X Theater Company, and actors West Liang and Elizabeth Ho on the company's current play, The Chinese Massacre, Annotated. And this is a play, for all of you who don't know, this is a play that dramatizes the first pogrom in L.A. history, the murder of 18 Chinese men in a mass lynching, and actually the largest mass lynching in the history of the U.S., by a mob of 500 people in 1871. And this is just after Los Angeles and its city fathers were busily trying to, spent 10 years earlier, trying to join the Confederacy. Okay, boy, how much has changed today. Yeah. Anyway, I'm really happy to welcome you guys to the show. Tim, artistic director. Elizabeth, actor.
Hi.
West, actor.
Hi.
Hi. And why don't you first, maybe we'll go with you, Tim. We'll talk about what's the story. Tell people the story of the play.
The story of the play, they're actually, it's a story within a story within a story. We tell the story of the 1871 riot and the circumstances that led to it. There's a framing device that happens 20 years later that looks back on the story. And then looking outside of that are annotations that break in to give us historical information that otherwise wouldn't be included in the story. But what you get is the full picture of not only the events that transpired, but ultimately a look back from our perspective at how little things have changed.
To me, it's sort of, yeah, it's looking back at how little things have changed, but sort of being in the moment of the play, and I found it really interesting that you guys had to do, you know, the way you chose to actually stage the thing was through this Brechtian epic theater.
Right.
Which, I mean, and you did it in a way that actually provided a lot of, there was comedy in it, there was also sort of a broke some of the tension, but there was this whole point of actually making people, as Brecht said, experience it intellectually and not emotionally.
Right.
But I still have to say, and with Elizabeth and West, you guys, you know, you played Elizabeth. Your character is Yot-ho.
Correct.
And yours is Lee and Lee Tong. You played,
yeah, that's
and
right.
You guys are at the center of this play in a lot of ways, the emotional center anyway. Had you heard about this story before?
I hadn't. I'm a Chinese-American, and I grew up in San Francisco, but I've now made Los Angeles my home, and I was very surprised when I was approached to take a look at this play that I had no idea about this history, especially as an Asian-American. I thought that I knew a lot about what happened in Los Angeles within this time period, but I had no idea.
West, what about you?
No, I didn't know anything about it until I read the script, and then I found it really, really fascinating and incredible. And me being Chinese-American as well, I found it kind of, there was a lot of pride in knowing that we have been a part of L.A. history for such a long time. But at the same time, you know, if curious that me being a Chinese-American knew nothing about this all through college, all through friends of mine growing up in L.A. So, yeah.
The reason I was going to raise this, and maybe what I'll do is I'll ask you, Tim, about why the choice to do it is Brecht's epic theater.
Well, you know, Tom Jacobson, the playwright, loves to set himself a challenge. And when we first discussed with Tom the idea of doing the play, this was the way he wanted to approach it from the beginning, the idea being that that was his insight ultimately into the story, that he, you know, he works at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles and had access to a lot of the archival documents, the newspapers, a lot of the public record. And the way to really dramatize that and get it into the script was to approach it in this Brechtian way with these annotators, but also ultimately to heighten the tension, that if we had approached it as a, in a regular linear fashion, I don't know that it would have been as impactful, because we get to step back for a moment and actually look at the big picture before we drill back down into the, you know, the characterizations of these historical figures.
You know, one of the things that happens, I think, at least happened with me, is that, and it takes into account Brecht's thing about experiencing it intellectually, but it also, that those breaks and those annotations actually really gave a chance for the emotion to settle in. And I wanted to say, both with West and Elizabeth, both of you, I mean, I'd ask you, and we're going to have you do a scene in just a minute, but I'd ask you about the emotional impact of the play on you. I mean, the characters you play, it was so deeply, I mean, so such a deep story and something that, you know, I think most of the audience was riveted on what was going to happen to you folks, what had happened, and the situation that you lived through. You concentrated so much of that time and of the incident. And how was it for you to play such a deeply emotional role and at the same time have it be, you know, at some points when it was right there, then there would be step back, there'd be an annotation coming out. And those annotations, by the way, are like pieces of history, or they're explaining different anachronisms in the play, things like that. And they're also putting things in context. So how was it for you guys in playing this very deep emotional role in the midst of all this?
Well, for me, when I first read the script, I found it really kind of fascinating. How am I as an actor going to approach this? Because there's the Brechtian thing, and then there's the detachment thing. But I, you know, with the director involved, with all the other actors, I in the scenes, I felt like I've got to approach it, you know, truthfully. And in that sense, you approach it like any other scene. And also, I think the annotation kind of helps you, it sort of bridges the gap that often, there's often a gap between audience and actors. And I think this sort of like brings you into the same experience. So the annotations actually help, you know, me as an actor in the moment, you know, kind of remind you what the audience might be experiencing as well.
Elizabeth?
I'm exhausted after this play is done emotionally, and I kind of get beat up a little bit too. You can't see it on radio, but I'm a little bruised. and that's from West roughhousing me. but I get emotionally very, very tired. My character is a very strong woman. She's been through a lot. And the annotations, like Wes said, they do help almost, it's almost Brechtian when you're acting, because you kind of get outside of yourself, because you're like, oh, I have a pause. This annotation's going on. And then you have to go drill right back in to your emotional life at that moment. But it's a rough one, for me at least.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Tim Wright, the artistic director of the Circle X Theater Company, and Wes Liang and Elizabeth Ho from the cast of the play The Chinese Massacre Annotated. Well, why don't we do the scene that you came to prepare to do, and why don't you let people know what it is, and then we'll go into it.
The scene happens shortly after Lee and Yut Ho are forced into marriage, and in 1871, the way that the Chinese gangs would transfer ownership of women from one gang to another was through marriage. So this was an American legal proceeding that was just forced on the two characters. So this is sort of the first time that they are alone in a room together.
I cannot love you, Li Tong. I am poison. My body is poison. I cannot love anyone.
That's not what I'm asking.
I cannot be touched by anyone. I've been touched too much.
Do you miss China?
I can't tell.
I'm happy here, but sometimes I miss it. There's an American word.
Homesickness.
My brother gave me a cure.
There is no cure for what I have.
It works for me.
What is it?
China.
China in a cup?
Chinese soil. Just a pinch. Drink it with water, and it is as good as going home.
Well, you have me in tears now, okay? This is sort of, just an extremely powerful, and especially thinking of that scene and thinking about what was concentrated in that whole, the whole period then, and still to this day remains. You know, we were talking earlier about the pogromish atmosphere against the Chinese people in Los Angeles and many other parts of the country, but in particular here, where, what people know as Chinatown today is not what Chinatown was in 1871.
Right.
And even there, one of the things that astounded me was that it was 10%, just with the 18 people, it was 10% of the Chinese population that got lynched that day. Yeah. Think about that. What the hell does that say? Boy. It's incredible.
Right, and with only 6 police officers at the time in Los Angeles and, a population of about 5,000, what you're really looking at and what I think people have a hard time understanding is a Wild West town with a very dark atmosphere. There were more opium dens and bars and brothels and saloons than any other type of business. So, when you have, men roaming the streets with firearms with, bad intentions.
That's the police you're talking about, right?
Well, among others, yeah.
Yeah. here's the thing, though. I know what you're saying, but it's also, to me, it also concentrated a lot about the social relations at the time and social relations that continue to exist to this day. This was a very hidden part of L.A.'s history and of U.S. history.
Right.
And John Johnson Jr., a writer, actually discovered this and was, and just went on and dug it out and really pulled a lot of the information together that I guess Tom actually used to write the play, his background to write the play.
Right.
And one of the things I was reading is he kept making the point that, look, you can call this, because I know there's a tendency to call it a race riot, but actually, I choose the word pogrom because he makes the point that there was no way that you could look at what the police did and what the elite in the city, what the ruling class in the city that actually had. You had Crenshaw. You had all these people who, you can look at all the streets in Los Angeles and you can find out the people who took part in this. It's very heavy,
right.
And they were seedy drunkards and, people who just enslaved women and did whatever they wanted, but they also were the elite ruling the city and much of California. And when you look at that, it really was an atmosphere of a pogrom.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, how little has changed, a lot of it is, I find it, when I watch the play and listen to the play backstage every single night that we do the show, I'm constantly reminded how close we are to that situation. Oftentimes, there's a line in the play, Curly Crenshaw says, history is past. And we often, in today's age, we often think, okay, yesterday's news is not news at all. And you think this is relatively recent history, and I feel a part of those people, not just the Asians, but also the non-Asians, because oftentimes it's about survival, things we do when we're afraid of change, when we're afraid of losing our positions in society. We often go to the outside and start blaming and jabbing other things, and that's still happening now.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Did any of you guys know about this character Biddy Mason before this play?
Not before the play.
Why doesn't somebody explain who Biddy Mason is? Because I didn't know either, and I was really, it was a very inspirational part of the play, her character all throughout it.
Biddy Mason in 1871 was a midwife, I believe from Georgia, who, when she came to California and realized she could manumit herself, became a freed woman, and eventually ended up owning property and becoming a very prominent figure at that point in time in Los Angeles. But after her passing for many years, her grave was unmarked, and very few people knew about her. But the church that she founded in the early 90s ultimately laid her a headstone and brought her to a little more prominence. But she was a very well-respected woman in that time. So considering the time period.
And this point of, actually, it was really interesting because this point of can different oppressed nationalities come together. And also, you know, there were a lot of white people who actually stepped in as well to aid the Chinese people that mm-hmm. were being slaughtered. And I think that was actually not the main aspect of it, but it's one that I think actually lends the play a certain amount of hope, not in a silly way, not in a sort of, oh, well, this is just sort of stereotypically we're going to say hope, because at the end of it, you're devastated. I think, Elizabeth, it's actually a lot of the audience is feeling what you feel, emotionally exhausted, you know, at the end. But it's a good exhaustion. And I think then piecing it all together and seeing the particular way it ends, it really does give you a vision of something could be different, you know, and it's very much the same today in terms of the relations, but there's also the possibility of something different emerging. So I want to thank all of you for doing this.
Thank you.
Well, this wraps up another show. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. You know, as I mentioned last week, we're in the vicinity of May Day, an international revolutionary holiday, and one that's celebrated by people in every corner of the world. It's a day when many people look to the possibility of a new world and make their desire to bring that world alive known to everyone. In that spirit, I want to read something from Bob Avakian's new book, Basics. Check it out. If you can conceive of a world without America, without everything America stands for and everything it does in the world, then you've already taken great strides and begun to get at least a glimpse of a whole new world. If you can envision a world without any imperialism, exploitation, oppression, and the whole philosophy that rationalizes it, a world without division into classes or even different nations, and all the narrow-minded, selfish, outmoded ideas that uphold this, if you can envision all this, then you have the basis for proletarian internationalism. And once you have raised your sights to all this, how could you not feel compelled to take an active part in the world historic struggle to realize it? Why would you want to lower your sights to anything less? All right, those are the words of Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's from his recently published book, Basics. You can't change the world if you don't know the basics. I want to thank all of my guests today, journalist Andy Worthington, Professor P.Z. Myers, and Tim Wright, Wes Liang, and Elizabeth Ho from the play The Chinese Massacre Annotated. I also want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and my production assistant, Henry Carson. And I want to thank all of you for joining us today. And keep on coming back. You know where we live. It's the spot where epistemology meets morality. The place where if you know something is right, you got to do something about it. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And so once again, to mark this May Day holiday season, we're going to go out with a really unique version of the Internationale, from Ani DeFranco and Utah Phillips.